Coming up today, we take a ride in a real-life Wonkavator, find out about a supersonic comeback, and meet a couple of moonwalking legends. You're listening to episode 323 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Bonnie Christian.
Hi.
Hello. Should we go straight to facts?
Let's do it.
Yes. Let's do it. Matt, what did you learn this week?
So if you have been in London, you would have noticed, and the UK in general, that it's been a very, very hot week. We've had temperatures around 33, 34 degrees.
Which to a lot of people won't sound that hot, but to British people is like meltingly hot.
Incredibly hot.
Bonnie, you're Australian. That's not hot.
Yeah, I've been in my element all week.
Yeah, this has just been normal for you. But for us, it's been very sweaty and very unpleasant at night to sleep. But if you're in London and have been on the tube, you would have noticed that the temperatures have also increased on many of the lines that you're going on. So the normal tube carriages have actually been sweatier and even more humid and clammy than normal.
It's true. Yeah.
There's a load of reasons for this, but one that I learned that I thought was quite interesting is that the clay that the tube tunnels are built into actually retains a lot of the heat. And in the last, what was it, 50 years since the tunnels were built, every year the clay has been warming up a little bit. So back at the beginning, the clay was around 14 degrees in temperature, that's Celsius, and now it's around 25. So even though it's hotter outside, the clay is actually just absorbing more heat as it goes along anyway.
That is one of the best facts you have ever brought to the podcast.
I wish that it was something I discovered myself, but I found it on a blog that has been shared quite widely, but it's interesting, isn't it?
So it's gone up by 11 degrees in 120 odd years.
Yeah, roughly. It's pretty,
and it varies, but
yeah, it obviously varies upon temperature and different lines and how deep they are, but it has increased and for other reasons as well. But TfL is trying to, I saw somewhere that they're trying to use hoovers and stuff like that to make the tunnels a bit cooler or something, which is
hoovers.
Giant hoovers.
Okay, next week I want to find out about the hoovers. How many helium balloons would you need to lift a 70 kilogram human?
150.
500.
Okay. No, it's 10,000. So 1,000 litres of helium lifts about a kilogram, so you need 70,000 litres to lift a 70 kilogram human, which is about 10,000 normal balloons. I'm not sure how you qualify what a normal balloon is, but a normal balloon, I guess a round party balloon.
Yeah, I'd say that's sort of the standard shape balloon. It's not one of these sausage dog balloons or something like that.
No, so you need 10,000 of the things. There you go. Bonnie, what did you learn this week?
Well, I'm still exploring London, and I found out that in the 90s, in protest to CCTV footage, a artist made 35 plasters of his nose and stuck them around Soho.
The noses of Soho, yes. Did you find them all?
I found 7.
How many are there?
Well, there were 35. I think there's maybe around 10 now.
Yeah, I've only ever seen a couple.
Yeah, they're pretty weird.
Yeah. Look up when you're in Soho, Matt Burgess, and you'll see some noses.
There's a couple of ears as well.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Fun fact, our first story this week, boom, Matt Burgess, boom.
Yes, boom. And that's the sound that supersonic planes make.
Brilliant.
Which,
just like that.
What this story is all about. So a company called Boom, a startup company based in the US, is aiming to bring back supersonic travel, which would...
For passengers, not for
passengers. And they're aiming to do so by around 2023. This week, they've announced that they have signed up 76, or they've got orders for 76 of their planes that they're making from 5 different airlines around the world. And they really want to just be the new Concorde.
Yeah, this is remarkable. So Concorde stopped running, was it about a decade ago?
It was around 2003.
There we go. So we've been without these majestic aircraft for a really, really long time. But there were good reasons why Concorde failed. So maybe we should go over those before we look at what's the next thing coming.
Okay, so a quick history lesson of Concorde. The Concorde as a plane and as a fleet started to fly in the 1960s. In late 69 was the first time that Concorde actually passed a supersonic sound barrier. And then commercial flights started about a decade later in 1976. And at the beginning, the flights were quite cheap. Actually, a ticket on the first flight cost £356, which is ridiculously cheap for, and that was from London to Bahrain. Most of the flights that Concorde did were from New York to London and vice versa. And over the years, as the service got the service got more expensive. I'm not actually sure why it got more expensive. I think possibly because demand went down and fuel prices went up, etc. But basically, the cost of flights over the years made it less commercially viable. And there were also reasons to do with a lack of flight routes. So London to New York was pretty much the only one that could be done. People didn't want the Concorde and its sonic boom flying over their land, flying over their houses. So it was really limited in that way. And there are also sort of environmental concerns about the planes and how they were flying as well.
Yeah, and safety concerns towards the end of it. So it was ditched, you said, in 2003, but now something different is back.
Yeah, so this new idea from Boom is to recreate supersonic planes and make it basically commercially viable for them to run a business. The company has been founded by Blake Scholl, who is a former Amazon employee. So there's a bit of a theme here with Amazon employees and Amazon staff. You've got Jeff Bezos, his name is easy to say, producing rockets with Blue Origin. And now you've got this guy, Blake, from the company who is working with supersonic planes.
There's also a bunch of people that have been involved in Boeing and Airbus, and there's interest from Virgin Galactic as well. So there's sort of a community within the Silicon Valley startup scene and outside of it. So aerospace and Silicon Valley coming together to try and crack this very expensive nut.
Yeah, and they have said that they're going to build a plane they're going to have a prototype by the end of this year. But one of their biggest things that they're working on is a jet fighter plane, basically, to prove that they can do the supersonic technologies. And they're saying that they have made adaptions to the aerodynamics of this plane and the passenger plane that they will build after this, changes to the aerodynamics, the materials, and different processes, really, to try and make this cheaper. So they say that they can actually do their flights at around Mach 2.2, which is 1,451 miles an hour, and Concorde's top speed was 1,300 miles an hour, roughly. So they say they can do it cheaper, they can do it more efficiently, they can make money from it, and I think their flights, they're roughly planning to be about $2,500. And that's a one-way leg between New York and London. So that is equivalent, they claim, to a business flight at the moment.
Yeah, it's about what a business class flight is. So this is impressive stuff. And to have a test aircraft that can hold around 40 people ready to go early next year for its first test flights, this is a remarkable pace of development.
Yeah, so there's obviously a lot that still needs to be done here, but the company has taken on more than 40 people. As we've said, they've got people from really big aerospace companies that are working with them. They've got a load of investment. People are obviously looking to come on board with the company and have orders and see planes built, like Richard Branson.
But it's smaller than Concorde. Concorde was around 100 people, and when this is fully developed, it will only hold 55. And when you look at pictures out of it, it does look really diddy.
Yeah, it looks similar to Concorde, but just not as big.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a lot more technical stuff to it than that and what makes it commercially viable. But that is one of the big things about this. They're obviously running a smaller plane, which will cost less to fuel, and they'll be able to sort of make these trips in a better way. So at the moment, they're talking about trips from New York to London, from Tokyo to San Francisco, and from Sydney to LA. They say that the New York to London one will be three and three quarters hours quicker than flying on a traditional flight.
So just 3 hours 15 minutes.
3 hours 45 minutes.
Quicker.
Yes.
But it will take 3 hours 15 minutes.
Yes, it will.
Yes.
Sorry, yeah.
That is quick.
That is very quick. And yeah, that's the overall idea of it. It's really ambitious. They obviously believe they can do it, and there's backers that are on board and think that it's probably possible as well. The technologies are obviously, supersonic flight has been around for more than 70 years, or the principle of it. So I think that to actually just make it commercially viable is the challenge, and that's obviously something that Concorde failed with. But these people in their Silicon Valley belief...
Yes,
think they can do.
They have the confidence. Do we need this, though? Is it something that the world needs? Like, Concorde's been away for more than 10 years. I mean, it was a wonderful piece of engineering, but it doesn't feel like we're missing anything.
Bonnie, you're obviously from Australia. Would this... You've probably done the 24-hour flight from UK to home a few times?
Yeah, well, I guess the Sydney to LA, I mean, sitting on a flight from... for 14 hours, I think sitting on it for what, maybe 7-8 hours maybe, would make a huge difference. Plus, they're doing the London to Perth flights next year that'll be 17 hours. So, I mean, that'd make a huge difference.
Yeah, you could probably get it down to under 10,
yeah,
which is the difference between feeling gross for days once you get there and maybe being able to recover a bit quicker.
Exactly.
Which I suppose is maybe different. I don't know if anyone in this room can afford a $6,000-$7,000 return flight to anywhere. But for people who are going to do business, particularly, I suppose, between Tokyo and San Francisco, London and New York, Paris and New York, this would make a really, really big difference because you could just pop over there and pop back.
Yeah, in 24 hours.
They say that actually for the London to New York, you could do it, go out in the morning and come back in the evening and do it as a day trip. I mean, it would be a horrible day to be getting up at like 4 a.m., flying across for 2 or 3 hours in probably a very nice level of luxury, but then having a few meetings and coming back. But people will do it. And I think that it's something that there is a market for supersonic flight. There are lots of questions around, the environmentally friendliness of this, and if other people really want it, but definitely for a business level flights, there will be an appetite for this, and smaller planes make sense in that respect because there are probably fewer people that can afford these types of flights, and if you can fill up a smaller plane with people that want it, then it's going to be better than a big empty, half empty plane.
Yeah, well, I imagine they were always filling Concorde, even with the bad economics of it. They must have had to have filled the plane in order for it to fly. There were only ever 20 Concordes that were built, and they've already got 76 orders for this. So my point is, there a demand for this? Well, there is, obviously, because the orders are rolling in. We'll be following the story very, very closely, and you never know, Matt, you might get to go and have a ride in one.
That'd be nice.
Yeah,
I think I'd go to New York. Never been.
And you could go in a day, so you'd never be able to see any of it. Our second story this week is also about travel, but somewhat more adventurous travel. Earlier this week, I was in Trondheim in Norway for Starmus, which is a little-known science festival that brings together some fairly extraordinary people. And amongst them were three moonwalkers, Charlie Duke, Buzz Aldrin, via video link, because he's a little unwell at the moment, and Harrison Schmidt. So there's only ever been 12 people who have walked on the moon. Six of them are no longer with us, so that leaves us with just six people who have set foot on another world. And as I was sitting there listening to them talk and had the opportunity to ask a few questions later, a thought occurred to me. They're not going to be alive for very long. They're all in their 80s. Some of them are of ill health. And even if they only live for another 10 or 20 or 30 years, which would be a good innings, shall we say, they'll be gone soon. And we face the very real possibility that we all live on a planet where there is no one alive who has walked on another world, which struck me as kind of sad and important.
It strikes me as a little bit morbid as a thought to be having while you're surrounded by all these amazing people, but it's a reality that could happen.
Yeah, so before we get into this, I asked Duke and Schmidt if they feel they have a special responsibility to share their remarkable experience with the world while they still can. And here's what Harrison Schmidt had to say.
So, but this it's not a, I don't think there's anything that's really a function of age. Astronauts that I'm familiar with, and this includes not only the Apollo, Gemini, Mercury era, but also shuttle and space station, are continually presenting their experiences as well as their ideas for the future to people throughout the world. And so I think that's a continuing responsibility that we all took very seriously. We certainly didn't pay for our trips, and the American taxpayer generally paid for the ones that Charlie and I took. And so there's a great responsibility to give back, no question about it.
So he makes the point that it's a responsibility for all astronauts, and obviously an awful lot more people have been to the International Space Station and around the Earth's orbit than have gone to the moon. But for me, there feels something very, very special, and that when these people start to pass and there are less and less of them left and they can't communicate their experience so well, that we'll lose something, we'll lose that link, and all of a sudden it becomes almost like science fiction, almost like history, particularly to kids who will maybe never meet someone that walked on the moon or never been alive at the same time as someone who walked on the moon.
Yeah, I imagine they were talking to kids at the festival, were they?
Yeah. So it's a funny old event, but it was hosted at a big technical university in Norway. And the audience was predominantly students. And when they came off stage, they were quite politely mobbed by kids that wanted to take selfies and wanted a handshake and wanted to ask a question. And, you know, you speak to an awful lot of astronauts and people who are very, very prominent in the fields in space. And they all have this sort of origin story of what got them into it. And quite often it will be seeing something on television, that chance encounter, a visit to Kennedy Space Center, something like that, something that really, really sparked their interest. And it's different watching something on YouTube or reading about something on Wikipedia or in a book. It's not the same as being able to be in the same room as someone. And a big part of their role now is, as Harrison said, they didn't pay to go to the moon. So they're essentially, their duty now is to pay back to the American people and the people of the world who helped to fund and make that mission possible. And they've been doing that for, well, in some cases, more than 50 years. And in that time, they expected us to go to Mars. They didn't expect that they would remain the last people to venture beyond the Earth's orbit. And yet here we are, 45 years since the last person stepped off the moon, and we're not much closer to getting to Mars. So there's this real sense of, not desperation, but they really want to use their influence, I feel, while they still can, to try and persuade decision makers in Congress and at the Russian space agencies and the European Space Agency that it matters to keep going further. Because once they're gone, maybe you lose some very persuasive voices, because you can't go, I went to the moon, why can't we go again?
Yeah, it's one of the things that's really remarkable about astronauts, how down to earth and analytical and serious in many cases that they are. That a lot of them come from engineering backgrounds or scientific backgrounds, because at the moment, to go onto the International Space Station, you have to have skills that will help the space station to keep running and survive. If something breaks, you have to be able to fix it, and you have to be able to make sure that it is be able to run and have people living on there. But also, one of the big parts of what astronauts are doing in space now is the communications. That's a huge part of their job. You see Chris Hadfield, famously, who was the singing astronaut and was the first to post loads of pictures onto social media and get loads of notoriety from it, but they all do it now. You follow a few astronauts on Twitter, you think that this is like a commonplace thing for people to be doing, but it's having that voice to say, actually, we need to do this, this is important for humanity, and also being able to understand the world and the universe that we live in. And as these people, that the six surviving moon men, as we can call them, because they are all men, they need to obviously keep saying their message for what time they've got left, and convincing as many people as possible that the moon and other planets are important places to go and explore and do things on.
That's
what Stephen Hawking has been saying at the same festival, hasn't he, that we need to go and find another planet to live on. And I guess those two things tie in together.
Yeah, I think there's this frustration amongst people who have not a vested interest but a real passion for this kind of exploration, that we have stalled. And this was a point that Buzz Aldrin made, that we stalled. We probably should have been a lot closer to getting to Mars by now. We should have a definite date. There should be a mission plan. But due to a variety of factors, the risk, the cost, politics, it's just not happening. And you can sense there is a frustration. But you still need to remember that we live in a really extraordinary period of time. So there are still people alive that have walked on the moon, and we're incredibly fortunate to be alive with them. But also, since the year 2000, we have had an uninterrupted period of human habitation of space. So if someone was born after November 2nd, 2000, they have never been, there's never not been a person in space while they've been alive.
It is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you think of the International Space Station, how big it is as well, I think that the span of it is like multiple football fields.
I think it's about the size of a football field. Yeah, and then there's the solar arrays that...
One of the biggest like man-made structures that has ever been built. And it was built in space, and it's traveling at 17,000 miles an hour and is completely incredible.
Yeah.
And we just take it for granted in some respects.
Yeah. Whereas there is to me, and I've got this feeling from the other people in the room as well, I've only ever met someone from the moon once before. Someone that went to the moon once before. It's a very rare privilege. And everyone in the room, it's just so much more excitement around them than, oh, you just went to the International Space Station? Well, that's kind of cool, but he went to the moon. So there is this difference. It was, as Neil Armstrong put it, it was humanity's greatest leap. one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. And hopefully we'll be making it again. And as a lot of people believe, the moon will become the staging post for missions to Mars. And maybe it will be that when we're getting on for the age of the moonwalker, so when we're in our 80s, that humans living on the moon will be completely commonplace. That certainly seems to be what an awful lot of people with expertise believe, and it remains to be seen.
Think of all that moon cheese as well.
Think of all that moon cheese. Well, actually, it turns out that all of that moon mineral, we're going to mine the moon for things like helium-3, which you can't get very easily on Earth, but there's tons of it on the moon. So, yep. That's why the moon's going to be important, because we'll make a lot of money from it. That was a very boring way to end that. Our third story this week is very, very exciting. Bonnie, earlier this week, you went to rural Germany to ride a Wonkavator.
I did. Well, I didn't get to ride it, but I got to see it. ThyssenKrupp, or is it ThyssenKrupp? ThyssenKrupp has brought the Wonkavator to life. They said that the elevator industry is handicapping the building industry, because elevators can only go up and down, and they can only go so high, about 500 metres. So the way that the industry is solving this is by building multiple shafts, which take up really valuable floor space. So ThyssenKrupp has made an elevator that doesn't have any ropes. It rides on a railway. It's basically like a metro system, but vertical in buildings.
Right. And it can go up ways, sideways, slant ways, all the ways. So it is, in essence, it's a Wonkavator, but it's a Wonkavator that's a bit like a train and a bit like a maglev train.
Yes, exactly. So the maglev train in Japan, it uses exactly that same technology. It rides a electromagnetic field around the building, and it can have multiple cabins, in the same shaft. So if you've got a couple of people who want to go to a south tower on the second floor, you can go get into that elevator and you can go all the way to that destination without having to stop. So it'll be quicker, it'll be more efficient.
And there could be like four or five cabins behind you that are all whizzing off to other parts of
exactly.
the building. And this was a really interesting point in your report, and you can watch your report, and there's a brilliant video on wired.co.uk, you should check it out. The cost, you don't really consider this. You've got a very, very tall building. Tall buildings tend to be quite thin. And once you start putting in maybe six elevator shafts, some of which go up express elevators to the higher floors, some of them stop at different floors, etc., etc. Once you've got all that in there, well, yeah, you're going to be using up a lot of square meterage. And you think of the cost of office space and apartments in dense city centres where you tend to build these blocks. And it seems madness that you take up so much room with elevators, but you have to.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So David Schreinbach, who's the CEO of ThyssenKrupp's elevator division, was saying that so shafts take up about 40% of this floor space, and the new maglev elevator will be about 4 to 5 times the cost of a normal elevator, but it'll overcompensate that floor space cost that you use. So really it's a long-term investment, and you make it up quite a lot. With this elevator.
And you mentioned Andreas Schramm back there, and you interviewed him. You can watch the full interview in the video, but let's have a little listen to a clip from that.
I think the elevator industry is a little bit handicapping the building industry. We can build buildings higher than elevator goes, and the need for capacity in buildings is unmatched. Higher buildings means more people have to go into buildings, and the way we are doing it today is we're just building more elevators. Today, 40-50% of high-rise building is used by elevator shafts. This cannot go on forever. The solution is having multiple cabins in one shaft, which is increasing capacity dramatically, reducing the waste of space.
As I said earlier, you can watch a full video and see the elevator in action on Wired's YouTube page. Head to youtube.com/WiredUK. Something else I didn't realise was that there's a physical limit at which an elevator can ride a rope.
Yes, so it can only go up to about 500 metres because I guess it gets too heavy. And what people do in buildings today is they get to 500 metres and then they have to get off and get on the next one and go the next 500 metres up. So this will really, I guess, transform the way you move people around buildings, which seems like a really simple idea, but I think it'll change a lot about how people will work.
And that's obviously gravity playing a big part in that with the rope situation. So what stage are they at now? You saw it moving, but is it in a building, isn't it? Where are they developing next? And sort of,
well, that's one of the really interesting things is that ThyssenKrupp has built a building specially to test these elevators. So there's a 246 tower in rural Germany, about an hour and a half southwest of Stuttgart. And it's got 12 elevator shafts in it. It's also got a viewing tower, which is the tallest in Europe. And basically, they test elevators there, and that's where the multi-elevator is. And you can stand behind a glass wall and you can see it in action, coming down, moving across and going back up again. It's quite cool.
Yeah, it looks very, very futuristic, all the sort of whizzing and whirring and the sounds of different, I guess it's there's pressurized air or something going on there. It's lots of like noise. It's very satisfying. If you like satisfying noises, then give the video a look. And they've got one client already. They've got one order in for a building that's going to be finished in just a couple of years' time. So this isn't super futuristic. This is going to happen really soon.
No, well, one of the creators of it, whose name is, he's known in the company as Mr. Multi, but his name is Marcus Jetta, said he's been with ThyssenKrupp for 26 years, and he said that this is the best moment in his career and he's really excited about it. Critics of his design said that it would take 10 years and that was only 3 years ago. And so in 2019, OGV Real Estate has bought the multi-system and they'll be building it, or they'll be putting it in their building in 2019.
And that's in Berlin?
That's in Berlin, yeah.
Yeah, so he can sort of give a big middle finger to all of the doubters out there.
Exactly.
Mr. Multi was right.
Yes.
The doubters shouldn't have questioned him.
Exactly.
It's amazing that there's I always find this when we talk about stories on the podcast, that there are people that have these jobs, people that have spent 26 years working in elevators, and now they're seeing, I think he described it as the biggest revolution.
Yeah.
In elevators in 100 and something years since the first one was put into a skyscraper.
Well, yeah, exactly. He's so passionate about them. In the previous story we did about him, he said that he'll admit to when he goes on family holidays, he'll walk away from his family and leave them to whatever they're doing, and he'll go and study the lifts in the building that he's in.
This is excellent, because someone has to, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Wired's own Vicky Williston is obsessed with tunnels. I'm a little bit obsessed with trains, but I have not dedicated 26 years of my life. And maybe I would on holiday. I go on holiday specifically to go on trains. But to go in a lift, well, yeah, I suppose it's fun too. You can read an awful lot more about the ThyssenKrupp Wonkavator, or Multi, as it's more sensibly called, on wired.co.uk. As I said, there's a video there as well. It's a really, really fascinating story, so do check it out. Our final part of the podcast this week, I'm going to try and make it a regular thing, is a quiz. And this week's quiz is all about this guy.
Hi, Elon Musk speaking.
It's 7 o'clock in the morning, and Elon Musk anxiously waits for his golden payoff, his prize for paying his dues in the Valley.
I expect to receive a car that I've just bought, which is called the McLaren F1.
It's $1 million for a car. It's decadent.
There are 62 McLarens in the world, and I will own one of them.
Back in 95, there weren't very many people on the internet, and certainly nobody was making any money at all. Most people thought the internet was going to be a fad.
Not this South African entrepreneur. Musk sold his first computer program at the age of 12, and he hasn't stopped selling since.
So yes, Elon Musk. Thanks to Elon Musk Best Videos, which is surely one of the best YouTube channels. This week, Elon Musk gave a few more details about his boring company, plans to dig tunnels under Los Angeles to try and solve some of its transport problems. He's a man with a finger in a lot of pies. But how much do you know about him? I've got five questions to test your Elon Musk knowledge. Matt Burgess, your buzzer goes...
I'm not doing a buzzer thing. I'm protesting after last week.
Fine. I will try and expense some buzzers, we'll see if we can get them in a couple of weeks' time. So, you got a little bit of a clue in that clip. Musk is a citizen of which countries?
Is that two countries? What?
He's a citizen of more than one country. I'm not going to tell you how many, but what countries is he a citizen of?
America?
Yep.
South Africa, as it said in the...
Yep.
There's more than two.
There's one more.
The UK?
No, this could go on for a while.
I'm going to say New Zealand.
No, go on, have one more. Someone might get it.
Hawaii?
No, that's not a country.
No, true.
India?
No. So he was born in South Africa. His mother was Canadian, and he moved to America. He only gained American citizenship, I think, in the early 2000s. So he's a South African Canadian American. So you both get a point each for getting two of the countries right.
Which weren't the obvious ones.
Yes. But still, you know. What is his estimated net worth in dollars?
Oh, wow. That is going to be a lot of money. There's SpaceX, there's Tesla, there's SolarCity, there's the Boring Company, does stuff with OpenAI and other investments as well. I am going to say $57
billion. $57
billion.
Bonnie?
I'm going to go with $100 billion.
Wow. You guys think this guy is, well, he's loaded, but he's not that loaded. As of May 2017, he had an estimated net worth of $15.2 billion, making him the 80th wealthiest person in the world. I'm not sure if he had a net worth of over $100 billion where that would put him, but I should imagine he'd be quite near the top. He's already in. He's doing all right. He's got enough for a fancy car or two. Why is Tesla called Tesla?
Presumably after... It's Nikola Tesla.
Yes, Matt Burgess, you win. Yes, Tesla is named after the electrical engineer and physicist Nikola Tesla. So 2-1 to Matt Burgess. How long did Elon Musk spend studying a PhD in applied physics and materials science at Stanford University?
4 years.
I'm going to say he spent 6 months and then dropped out.
Oh, yeah. So, Matt, you're closest. So I think I'll give you the point because you got the right idea. 2 days. He left to take advantage of the internet boom, which went rather well. Zip2, which he founded in 1995, was sold for $307 million in 1999, earning Musk $22 million for his 7% share. And this was around the time that the video that I just played a clip from was made. So he just earned his big money from Zip2 by then. So 2 days. Matt Burgess, you take an unassailable 3-1 lead, but we'll finish off. Which fictional superhero is modelled on Elon Musk?
Do you want this one? Do you want it as the point that is?
No, I've got no idea. I really need to study up on my...
Yes, yeah. You need to spend some time on the Elon Musk Wikipedia page.
I do.
It's Iron Man, Tony Stark. So director Jon Favreau asked Robert Downey Jr., who plays Tony Stark, Iron Man, in the films, to spend some time with Musk to see if he could learn anything for the character of Tony Stark. And he based certain attributes of his character and the way that he goes about his business on his time spent with Musk.
I didn't know that, but I assumed that was like the fairly obvious one.
Oh, yeah, no, he actually, you went and hung out with him for a little while.
Oh, so some of the personality traits are of Musk. That's telling.
Yeah, yeah, there we go. So now you know an awful lot more about Elon Musk. Another quiz next week. I'll see if I can get some buzzers. Matt Burgess, congratulations on your astonishing victory.
I think I'm going to have to spend the next afternoon watching YouTube.
Yes, Elon Musk best videos, I recommend it. He's such an interesting guy. We'll leave it there for this week. Thanks very much. We'll see you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.